Welcome back to another episode. I'm incredibly honored and humbled to be having this discussion with Charles today. Charles is a, remind me of the pronunciation?
Nyingana
man from the Kimberleys in Western Australia, with over 20 years of experience in Indigenous affairs across Australia, delivering programs nationally. He holds a Master's of Public Administration from Harvard University in the USA and a Bachelor of Science Geographic Information Systems from the University of Western Australia. Charles has significant experience in the corporate world, previously leading the global supplier and procurement diversity process for Australia's largest construction company, Lendlease, as well as several other prominent roles, such as the CEO of Supply Nation, establishing the Indigenous Procurement Policy, which was pivotal in increasing First Nations business representation with federal recognition and endorsement. But what we are here to talk about today that I'm excited to learn about and share with our audience is the book that you've recently published on the Voice to Parliament, small plug. And this is the focus of our conversation, but not just the Voice to Parliament. What I want to traverse with you, Charles, is the mental health impacts of that, because that is my domain. Mm. And before we jump in, I will ask one thing of you, if that's okay, and that is to call me in if I get it wrong, because this is a topic that I guess I'm a little bit scared of, that I'm going to say or do something that my intention wouldn't be to offend, but if at any point I go off course, please call me in and help me learn if that's okay.
Sure.
Thank you. And we have, I'm a big believer that instead of just asking you to do the educating for us, we need to do some heavy lifting before we come in.
Oh, well,
so I'm going to start there around what I believe the voice is in my own, well, not in my own words, but in words that I've learned, play that back to you and then help that as a frame for then where we take that in mental health. Does that sound okay?
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay, so here's what my understanding of the voice is. A body that may make recommendations and representations to Parliament and government. So it's the first sentence, which I underscore, may make recommendations about matters relating to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, i.e. a specific community, that's independent and specialised in nature, from a group elected and chosen by Indigenous Australians, based on wishes and needs from local communities, with all inputs from the body going to Parliament, who ultimately has control of the resulting decisions.
That's right. Good.
So
I think that's a wrap.
If that's a wrap for us, and if you agree with that is a fairly factual definition of what the voice is, then I've come with three things that I believe this comes down to for Australian citizens. One, do we believe in giving people a right to advocate for their needs? Two, are we, the citizens of Australia, able to facilitate or grant, and I hate that word, grant the right, but unfortunately, I think that's the tone of the conversation, grant control to a group that so often does not have nearly the amount of control they need to survive and thrive without sacrificing our own sense of control, i.e. it's not a zero-sum game. And three, can we have the courage to step into the unknown? And I think that that's the big thing here, is that so many people are like, yeah, but we don't know what that looks like. And but what if, but what if, but what if? And I think one of the biggest lessons I've learned about anxiety in my own mental health journey, completely agnostic to anything to do with this topic, is that you got to be courageous. There is always risk, and we can't control all risk. And as a country, if we believe in being brave, it means walking into unknown territories without having every single fact down, but enough to make courageous decisions. How would you reflect on my take just then?
I think there's one word that you use is kind of the word control.
Mm.
That actually, for some reason, is a little bit of a, I don't know, a trigger point.
Yes.
Because, I mean, I agree, and I think we should have control of our lives, but the problem with that mentally for me is that that word has been used It's a very powerful word. And this word of control for me, and I haven't really thought about this, but that particular is in relation to power.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, absolutely, people should have power and control over their lives, but we've been talking about control for 200 something years. We have been controlled, and now we're asking Australians of after 230 years of oppression and all everything that's come with it, they're using that word as control. So it's kind of like I'm conscious that word is also a trigger point for non-Indigenous people. They're like, so they give it, we have to give up control, which is a power word, right?
Mm.
So I absolutely want control. We've had control taken us, but in the process, we're asking non-Indigenous Australians to give up control. And I think that is part of the heart of the matter.
Yeah.
And I've been around for a couple of years now. And it's only probably in the last five that I've kind of grown into my career, really. And the whole imposter syndrome, right? Like we all have it. And I've had it for a while. But I think as I've gotten older, I'm almost 50. I'm okay with that now. But as a result, and I'm also okay with what I've achieved and, you know, the level of experience and that I can bring to this conversation. Like I don't cower from the fact that I can bring experience and thought and leadership to this. I used to kind of, you know, I'd veer away from saying that. But I know now this word control is part of the conversation.
Yeah.
And it's a hard one, right? We want control of our lives, but in the process, I'm asking non-Indigenous Australians to recognise that they've had control, and that's quite upsetting for me because of everything that's come with it. But I recognise, I'm not stupid, right? Like if the non-Indigenous person, whether they know it or not, and what they're being asked is to give up control, and to your point of the unknown, that's what they're scared of.
Mm.
They're scared of losing control. The discourse that has happened, you know, ever since the Prime Minister said he would commit, actually even before that, when the Uluru Statement came out in 2017, I think it was 2018, it was given to the Australian people, to you, to people at the end of this podcast. It wasn't given to the Prime Minister or the opposition leader or the premiers or, the CEOs of corporate Australia. It was asked of Aussie people, citizens, neighbours, family, friends, you know, people that you play with, drink with, party with, work with, you know, shop next to. That's who it was given to. And so... the discourse was taken completely from the start. At the time, the Prime Minister, and he dismissed it. And you know, it was Malcolm Turnbull, and he's since changed his tune, which is nice. The frustrating thing with what happened is that it was a lack of respect right from the moment it was given, and then a politician, the Prime Minister, and there were other politicians there that took it and they made comment. They never asked the people that gave it. They never sat down and had a meeting before they made a public statement. They made these statements like a third chamber without talking to the people who'd crafted the words. And I just think that was a huge lack of respect from the get-go. And that's, I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, that's another word, respect. So if we've started this talk around building a as factual as possible construct of what the voice is, and then we're going to chunk down and say part of this is about moving into the unknown, where non-Indigenous Australians are being asked to quote unquote relinquish something that isn't actually theirs in the first place, i.e., having a right on a say around Indigenous Australians.
Yeah.
So essentially giving back what is already Indigenous owned, that should have largely no negative consequence. But even if there is, do we have appetite for risk?
Yeah. Well, I think now I remember your point. Does it negatively impact on non-Indigenous Australians? The no case is often built upon you will lose. And the reality, if you actually look into all of those points and those kind of accusations and fears, they're not real. For some reason, we have to break down people's fears. And the fear is they will lose something. They will lose something. The first answer is no. And it really upsets me because, and it's really hard not to get into and I don't want to, a tit for tat, but like when someone says to me, and I've had a person who's come from overseas and made a life for themselves here, they were brave enough to ask me, they're worried about what they'll lose. They built a business and they're worried they would lose it. First of all, that's completely wrong. I want their business to succeed. They are succeeding. I had a BMW like outside the cafe. Good on him. I'm jealous. Great. I don't want his car. I want to earn my car of my own. But then he's like, when people say we'll lose, I'm like, try losing your kid, man. Try seeing your grandfather drunk. Try going through a brief abuse. Try that, and then I'd tell me what you're going to lose. Try like generational, you know, loss. Try genocide, and then tell me what you're going to lose. But it's not productive, and it upsets me because it's my family and my people, and I've got stories. Most Aboriginal people do have stories. I can give you one. But then we get accused of like, just get over it. And here comes the violin. Like, here they're going to give us another sob story. But it's real, right? But their fear for them is real. They're worried they're going to lose something. We have lost. I don't know if it's productive to compare notes, but I can't escape the reality and how upsetting that is for me.
Rightfully so. Rightfully so. And I think with humans, from a psychological standpoint, we have loss aversion built into our DNA. You know, we would prefer to not lose something than gain something.
Yeah.
That's playing out right now, is that fear is at the center of all of this. What is mine that I might lose? And I think the question is, what might we be able to give?
Well, there's two parts to me. When someone says, what might I lose, right? And you address their fear, but then they keep coming. Or they go, I'm not going to lose my house. Cool. But what about this? And then I have to address that. But what about this? Like, am I ever going to satisfy? Are you just going to keep giving me reasons for no? Like, what is enough for you?
What is enough for you? I can hear the charge that has in you, again, rightfully so, given you've been campaigning now and you're at the end of the trail and you're exhausted. And a lot of this comes down to this, I would imagine, when generations are consistently perhaps told or they believe that I am not heard, I'm not seen, I'm not validated, my humanity is being stripped, then we're getting into like a self-worth, self-esteem conversation. And have you seen that play out in communities leading up to this vote or even outside of this vote? What is it like in community where people don't feel like they're being seen and heard and recognised?
No, it's multi-layered.
Emotionally, the mental health impact?
Well, yes. I mean, I went home back to the Kimberley in August and I was speaking to a brother cousin and I was explaining the whole voice, you know, first of all, people say, Charles, you know, they don't know who I am. And they say, you should go out and listen to Aboriginal people. Like, well, I am. And you should like listen in remote Australia. Well, yeah, I've gone. If you'd looked at my LinkedIn, you know that that's true. And so I've spoken to family in remote and one brother could not get past, and he kept saying to me, Charles, you're not listening. Native Title is doing this. And after 2 hours, and you know, I lost it, and I said, I am effing listening. and you said this, this, this. And he goes, oh, you're right. You did hear me. And I'm trying to say you are stuck. And I don't want to say that. It's his world and his truth in this world of native title. I'm trying to help lift you out of this issue, this, you know, ecosystem or whatever it is, this cloud, this trap you are in of native title. And I want to help rise above. Let's talk about what if we didn't have, or right, if we could move beyond native title. And he just couldn't, right? So that was his pain. And you could see his pain. And it would upset me to see a brother trapped in this world created by non-Indigenous people. But that's his life, and I'm not going to dismiss it.
Mm.
And for all the conversations that I've had, and I just had one with a senior man, an older man, white man, my neighbour in Surry Hills.
Mm.
And he'd been around. He said he'd worked with President Nixon and others in America, and he was veering towards the no. He still might. But we could have a decent chat, right? And his truth is his truth. I'm not going to deny that. But we should be able to have a conversation. And people don't ask me about my truth and my pain. When I first wrote this book, I was stuffed. Like, we had to keep pushing the deadlines. And I think I almost broke the publisher's like everything, the printer, the publisher, the media release and everything. I could not function that day after it was done. I literally made a cake because it was the only thing that was going to give me joy. I don't veer away from the fact now that I make cakes, you know, I stuff it. That's what makes me happy. My brother called, or rather my brother texted me and triggered me. I called him back, and another cousin brother answered the phone, and they were drunk. Happy drunk, sort of. And I again had to be on the spot and explain this voice and my book. And they were swearing, and one was swearing, the other one wasn't, telling the other one to shut up. And I don't think I'd been that low for a long time. But I told myself, if I can't do this now to my family, and they are drunk, my brothers, and I have to experience this, if I can't do this, then I can't do it.
Mm.
But I did, right? I pushed through, and after about 2 hours, one of my brothers had been telling me about loss, and he said, Charles, you know, I've seen people killed. What are they going to do about our groundwater? You know, that's our Leon, that's our soul, that's our dreaming. What about what Rio Tinto took? And I don't trust, you know, these bureaucrats. You know what they did, Charles? And I was there at the land council and blah, blah, blah. That's his truth. It happened.
Mm.
He was stuck, and I had to keep answering over and over again, just, oh, what about this, Charles? What about this, Charles? And it got to a point where I swore, and I told him, because you told me, and I was yelling by this point, because I was done. I said, you told me to keep going. All of you told me to keep it at uni. You're doing good. You're doing good. You'd come back and help us out, brother. And I've been overseas, and I've run these organizations, I've been to Harvard, and I'm effing telling you, this is what we need. Because without it, we're fucked.
Mm.
And then there was silence just like this, and he said, okay, I believe you. And I could have just like passed out. He goes, but bro, you had to swear, and I had to hear you. And then my brother, who was in the background yelling about Rio Tinto, came in earshot, and he goes, you right, bro? I was like, yeah. He goes, you there? Yep. You looking after yourself? Yep. I believe you now. And he said, but I had to hear you. That happened on the day of that book launch, and the media release had come out, and I had not posted. And the publishing company, I'd gone quiet, and I didn't come up for air for 2 days. And they were worried. about me.
Yeah.
I just couldn't come up. I think I sent people into a bit of a spin, but I had to disconnect.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's a little bit.
No, no, it's a beautiful story. Thank you for sharing. And the what happened in that moment for your brothers, I believe you now. I hear you.
Mm.
What do you think was that moment?
Well, there were a couple of things I've since learned is they went on for a while and I had to listen to them. I didn't have to, but that's how I do. That's how I operate. And as I said, it's their truth. And then what, for me, what happened is I said to them, I've listened to you for 2 hours now. You said one question and you said 30 seconds and we're into 2 hours. I said, and all of your truths are your truths. I said, now listen to my, well, I didn't actually. I just said, I'm telling you my effing story. Yeah. I'm like, so fair's fair. I've had to like listen to you. Now my truth is this.
Yeah.
And I think because like they heard me and they heard my truth. And I go, yeah, this bloke, he knows what he's talking about. And he's really upset and we love him and he's our brother and like he's not bullshitting us, right?
Yeah.
But that came from a gut.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, I write about it in the book and they said to me, bro, you look after your Leon, which is your, like your little person inside you for us, your spirit, your soul, but for us it's a Leon. So we say things like, oh, that make my Leon feel good or that make my Leon feel no good. You know, so that's for us, that's what it is. And they kept saying, you look after your Leon, bro. And I knew they were right. I went home. I had to go home after writing that book. My mother is in the book. She'd had a cold for like 3 months, like two colds, and they each last three colds. And like my dad was getting old. I had to go home.
Mm.
And even my cousin, who's my business partner, was trying to understand why. And then, you know, he saw me and I was going to go home for 2 weeks. And he says, go home for a month, go home for however long you need.
Yeah.
And I did. I still did some work, but yeah.
To take care of yourself.
Yeah.
And that's kind of this metaphor of what happened in your own family, I think, is what's happening in Australia is we've got Indigenous, non-Indigenous, yes, no. And the tension, I think a lot of it is just coming from either side not having the willingness and space to at least hear the other version. And in all the ironies in the whole world, the campaign is called The Voice.
Yeah.
You know, like it is allowing each side to have a voice. And in mental health, when we teach connection, the biggest part of connection is listening. And I think what you're saying is that have your truth, have your opinion, but the most important thing is giving someone the respect of being heard.
Exactly. You know, the neighbor today, he was sweeping his courtyard and, you know, I said to him, look, do you want a copy of my book? I'm not sure. I don't want to be seen to like pushing stuff onto you. And he told me about, like, he was a neighbor. And I respect that. But what I really enjoyed, he challenged me, but he heard me as well. He said, no, look, I'll read your book. And, you know, we have both a right and a responsibility, which is what excites me as citizens of a nation to make decisions and influence the direction of this country. So I am asking you to hear me and let's have a conversation as adults and then you make a decision. You use your right and your responsibility to be part of society, because that's what it is as well. It's a responsibility to set the course of this nation, right? Mm-hmm. We live in it together, so let's decide together. And I think if people can appreciate that and know what comes with that responsibility, like, think about it. Think about your thinking, like, not just for you or for me, but for your neighbor, for the grandkids, for the grandkids' grandkids.
Mm.
Like, if you really think about it, like, that's pretty important, right?
Very, very much so. And the this is getting a little bit personal, but you're tired right now, and I get it. And some of that is just by sheer workload.
Mm.
You know, hours that you put in writing a book, everything else, amount of conversations you're having. That's just like a scientific, energetic output that would make anyone tired.
Mm.
What do you think is the real reason that's shaken you in the last month or so, maybe more? Like, what is the story that you're telling yourself? What's the core need right now that maybe isn't getting met?
That's not getting met.
Yeah. What's maybe not feeling heard within you?
Well, you know, this is good. Like, I don't tell that story about my brothers and the conversation.
Mm.
A lot of people don't get to hear that story.
Thank you for trusting me.
That story is probably one of the most important. And I don't tell it because it is personal, but, you know, I'm starting to share it.
Is it because what I got from that story is the need that I'm hearing from you, Charles, is like, why can't people take the time to genuinely value my experience?
Yeah. It's true. I don't know if I have to justify my, see, the problem is, do I have to come in and justify myself every time, right? And that's probably like, why did you get me here? And not this here, but why am I a speaker? Why did you even ask me for? Like, do you see me? Do you see that I've done this stuff? Do you see that I do have a brain? And I don't want to disrespect you either. Mm. I think that's, I'm hoping, I've tried to get that point across as well, that maybe that's the thing.
Mm.
I'm a person and you're a person. Can we have a conversation as people? I feel like it's a transaction.
Mm.
And like, I have to justify all the time. Like, I have to win you over, right?
All right. So
you don't have to do anything.
Yeah. I hear you. Yes.
Like, that's an horrible, what would you call it? Imbalance of power. And even the word power, it's just an imbalance, right?
Yeah.
I have to win you over. Mm. After 200 and something years, 65,000, all of those generations and culture and story and my parents and grandparents and my families, not just mine, but the ones in Tasmania, the ones in South Australia, I have to win you.
Mm.
While I can survive and I do have an apartment, I had to earn all of that. And then we get accused of being elites. And I kind of think, well, stuffy is, I'm a black elite hottie. There was a sign at the walk. Someone says, we're for the black elite hotties. And I love that sign. But I still have to win. And that's been like that all my life.
Yeah.
And for all Aboriginal people, we have to convince you again and again and again and again. You don't have to convince us because you've already got power.
I think I'm now starting to understand where the feeling of tired comes from.
Well, maybe I am too.
Like, there's not that innate level of openness, respect, a moving start, momentum from anything from micro exchanges through to macro political conversations. Mm. There is this constant uphill battle to want to be equals, and that doesn't sound like a very human experience, nonetheless, very pleasant experience.
And, you know, I tell people, and for Aboriginal people, if you're a gardener, a lawyer, a doctor, a painter, a cafe owner, a waiter, half of our job is to educate other people. It is. And you ask any black fella, how much they've had to educate a non-Indigenous person again and again and again. Like, it's almost, I'm almost like shocked when a non-Indigenous person goes, yeah, I know all of that. You don't need to tell me. What else? You're like, oh, so I don't have to spend like an hour winning you over now. No. I don't even know what to do with that. And I get frustrated. You know, these talks and people have said, you know, and it's, oh, maybe you should try this. Maybe you should try that. Have you, and, you know, it's very
advice-giving mode before connecting with you.
Like, again, we've lost our kids, man. What do you think we've been doing?
Yeah.
What do you think we haven't tried that? And it's that, again, what it is the level of, I'm sorry to say, but it is patronizing.
Fuck yeah, it is.
And it's like, you know, you don't think we're smart enough to think about this?
Which makes
me angry now.
100%. Obviously, I can never relate in the context that you're talking about. I can relate, though, from a mental illness perspective. If someone comes up and says, hey, I'm feeling anxious, if the first response the receiver gives is, oh, you should, or have you thought about it? It's like, you miss the whole point of what I'm trying to get from you, which is to feel heard.
Yeah.
I'm trying to connect with you right now. There is loneliness and guilt and shame and narratives at play that are far more damaging than the actual solution. I and whoever else, the team, the network that supports me, can get to the solution.
Yeah.
I need to be heard and met where I am first. And I spend every day, all day, trying to help people understand that exact thing, validate, or at least try and get curious to where someone is before you move them anywhere else. And I think maybe that's what you're experiencing in from a Indigenous and a racial conversation perspective, not a mental health one, which is stop jumping straight to solutions. Hear us first around what we feel, and then we'll get to the practical implications and solutions after that.
Yeah. For other people, I suppose I would have thought, certainly I would hope that I have empathy, being someone who disadvantaged knows what minority stuff feels like and not being heard. But, you know, I do have bias, I try to be conscious that I have bias and then deal with it if I can when it happens. I try that. But I'm like, you know, because of that, I'm like, what do you need? Like, I don't think I'm going to lose by helping you. Like, really? I mean, like, if you talk about solution, like, will I lose? No. And sometimes it's like, I don't even know if you need to think about will you lose. It's like, well, will you gain first? Will I help you be a better human being? Or can I help you be a better? Is that what you want? Is that what you want? If that's what you want, and if that's what I can do in any small measure, then I will try, if that's what you want. Because I want to help a brother, a sister. I mean, I know what it's like to feel pain. It sucks, man. Why would I want to wish that on another human being? And I think that's what bothers me in this conversation. Is like, have you really thought what it's like? And is that what you want? And I think that's the sad thing. If that's what you really want, I don't know. I'm out. I don't know. If that's what you want, if you want me to feel pain, if you want another person to feel pain, I can't fathom that.
And this is backed up in research. So the nation's peak psychiatric body believes the voice will have, this is presented by The Guardian, will have a positive mental health benefit for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, saying self-determination is critical for improved outcomes in Indigenous Australian communities. So, you know, that idea of self-determination, to me, putting it outside of that language and into a sphere that I know, mental health psychology, is autonomy. It is resilience. It is control to some extent,
in a positive sense.
Yeah.
To the right people.
Correct. Well, control is a very healthy thing. Yeah. The psyche needs it to feel safe.
Yeah.
You know, and the brain is a risk mitigation device. So when we feel as if we have the means in which we can construct and protect the things that are most important to us, and we have a way to get that reality, that's safety. That's psychological safety. Yeah. And in some ways, this conversation is about, do we want to increase the psychological safety for our First Nations people by giving them more control over their own life? And the word give, I don't know, yeah. that's a much better word than give. By, what's the word there? By X?
You know, can we all experience the same level of control together safely, you know, both individually? You know, who knows what magic can happen when you do that on a collective basis?
Yeah.
Right? If I'm safe, you're safe, and we're safe, and we trust as a result, because you know what comes the next step is, if you do this, I'll do that. If you know I'm going to do this, and I know you're going to do that, well, I trust you. What's the next step we can take that we don't know about?
Yeah, I think that's kind of a beautiful poetic callback to when we started this conversation, the fear of the unknown.
Mm.
Let's look at that in a different lens. What about the magic of the unknown?
The magic. You know, we're starting to see that now. For example, you know, it's somewhat being forced upon us, you know, again, because we don't listen to each other, but climate change, right? The fires, and more now we're getting like, or maybe that whole traditional fire management thing is a goer, right? Maybe if we use traditional fire management techniques, we can manage country, and then as a result, manage the level of bushfires and then manage safety for people in their homes, right? And as a result, maybe look after country and have a functioning planet with animal life and variety of biodiversity. Maybe we could do that, right? And, you know, I try to, like, those words, biodiversity and climate change, you know, they might be akin to some kind of, you know, big words. I try to keep it relatively simple, right? It's about trust, doing it together, right? Now we could have a really wonderful life together.
Mm.
What if we could use Indigenous knowledge around plants and animals and the medicinal purposes and help each other medically in a safe way that Mother Nature kind of intended, or at least we could use our ingenuity around harnessing Mother Nature's capabilities for the benefit of all? What if we could use those very plants and animals, particularly the plants, for food? You know, who's that number one chef for the number one restaurant in Sonoma from was it Norway or whatever?
Mm.
And he came here a couple of, I'm sorry, listeners, but like he came here, right, and he used native ingredients. And he was just blown away.
Mm.
And he said things like, oh, I know how to do it, what I can do with a potato 3,000 ways and what I can do with a carrot. I want new stuff, right? What if we could harness that and send it out into the world together, collectively, not just as a First Nations thing, but as an Australian thing? We are different from every other country. Think of the magic that we could do. If we could do, like, there's an First Nations sign language, right, which is not Auslan. What about that? Mm. What about using that, you know, together and sending that out into the world for everyone?
Mm.
What about language? What about stories together? What about the fact there is no once, you know, one of the things with this voice, like one of my feelings is if we could do this, right, I would hope people go, it's not about the First Nations people, right? Like we have to address disadvantage. But if we can do that, what's the next step?
Mm.
What if I'm Australian, you're Australian, 65,000 years is acknowledged, not just 130. What about that? What if you go overseas and it's like, I'm Australian, man, and we are pretty cool. Yeah, we acknowledge First Nations people, they're Aussie, and I do the same thing.
Mm.
Like there's a difference at the moment. People say it will divide us. There's division now. I don't want to feel different, but I do.
Mm.
And I have felt different ever since I was born.
This might be something you've spoken about previously. Apologies if it is. We can move past it if so. This is kind of something I think about a lot, and I haven't had the opportunity to ask someone about it. I think it has a mental health lens, but I'll just say it. When I watch a country like New Zealand, which has its own challenges from an Indigenous, non-Indigenous integration perspective, but as a rugby union fan, I watch the haka at the start of the game and it gives me chills. Now, of course, it gives you most people chills because of just the power and ferocity in that process. But I think what actually gives me chills is seeing white fellas standing next to Indigenous fellas singing the same tribal ceremony song, and that there is a deep respect to the point where the white community actively not just allows, but embraces, celebrates, and identifies with that culture. What does it look like for the Australian rugby team to be performing in a First Nations dance before a ceremony like that, with white people included? Like, how do we get there?
Well, you're right. And, you know, I wonder if New Zealand, that just didn't happen overnight. You see, like, the product of probably change over a generation.
Mm.
And that's what we have to go through. But what that shows is it's possible. We have to go through it, though. I don't think New Zealand just woke up and did it straight away.
No.
So that tells us it's possible. That tells us what we could be. And it tells us it is possible. And it might be you. I can't give you that answer now. Mm. I don't know. I know as much as you do.
Yeah.
But we'll figure it out together.
Yeah, I would love to. And I think that ties back to the magic, which is what is the unknown could have risk, but it could also have upside that we can't imagine. And it might unify and bring Australia to a level that we never thought possible. And we need to dream.
In some of the AFL, because I'm an AFL person, you do union, which I had to learn the difference between league and union, by the way, like never the twain shall meet.
Yeah.
You've seen, like I'm a Richmond supporter, you see them when they do some of those really cool things on the MCG, and nearly everyone cheers, right? I'm just bet there are like some of the non-Indigenous players. Well, first of all, they did join them. Like, I want to be in there. I want to get in there. Can I do it too?
Yeah, they're brothers.
Why not?
Yeah.
And I think they've done that. They've started to do that at those games. And you say they're brothers because they play together. They work together. They have to rely on each other out in the field. They have to trust that someone's going to pass. They have to forward think, well, I know what he's going to do. He's going to do this, or I need to be ready. And then I'm going to do this, so they need to be ready. Like, that's how the game works. Otherwise, you won't win. You have to work as a team. Why can't we work as a team? You know, and figure it out together.
Mm.
That's what I'd like. And look, I hope we can. The fact that I'm here, the fact that you asked me to do this and that you're interested says a lot, you know?
Super interested and super grateful.
I'm grateful as well, so.
Thanks, Charles. Yeah. I'm glad that you feel psychologically safe to speak your truth today, because that if we can't give you that space, then the whole thing's...
Yeah, we're all taking a leap of faith, aren't we?
Yeah.
You know, maybe I could have told you no. I could have. And you might not have been interested to ask, but you did.
Yeah.
So we're here.
And what is... I know that, you know, that there is a lot of hope for right now at the time of the recording this podcast. We're a week away from the referendum. So it'll come out next week with enough time for people to listen to make up their own minds. But for you, for Charles Prowse, when you sit down next Sunday morning and wake up, what are you feeling either way first? So is there at least clarity at that point and certainty either way that will allow you to rest?
Don't know. I suppose partly because I have, you know, I've had quite a bit of experience, not as much as some, you know, and I pay my deepest respects to my elders and people who've been in this domain for a while because I was almost going to say fight, but I like it's really hard. Like you gotta, I don't want to use that language. But I suppose what I'm saying is there's half of me that tells me I've built a level of resilience and I can just deal with what is. The other half is saying, you know what, I'm not going to talk to any white person on Monday if it goes down. And I'm just going to close my blinds and I'm probably going to go fetal or, you know, oh, maybe I'll just get drunk and I have a wicked hangover or whatever. I think the reality is I'll be extremely sad. And it'll sit with me for a long time. I will go, keep going. And there's still work to do. And we win and there's work to do. We lose and there's work to do, you know? Like it's a little bit like, you know, you get a kick up the butt, just keep going, you know, be tough enough. But it is important to realize it's going to be hard, really hard. And I almost don't want to take the calls of, are you okay? Like, I don't need them. I don't. Just leave me alone. And I wonder if that's how a lot of people, mental health or whatever issues, like I just need my day. Don't call me. Don't bother me. I'm just going to wallow in my world of sadness today.
Stuck to feel it.
Yeah. And maybe I'll come up for air tomorrow.
And what does the celebration look like?
It's almost as sad. No, it's not sad. it's an whole shit moment. It's like, okay, one battle down, let's keep going. Really, that's to be honest, it's going to be awesome. It's going to be awesome, but, you know, half of me says, yeah, savor it for the day. As much as you were going to wallow for a no, savor it for the day and then still pick yourself up and go. And I was there on the steps of Parliament House or outside on the lawn when the apology was given. We drove down to Canberra, our friends and I. Well, we knew it was coming, though. That was the good thing. We knew it was coming. But when it happened, it was sad. And joyous, and tears of loss, and tears of love, and tears of hope all at once. And it was also connection as blackfellas, but connection with everyone was there, connection with everyone who was dancing and cheering, you know, on the live cameras at Federation Square in Perth and Canberra and Sydney. It's like, and someone said to me, who was non-Indigenous and from overseas and had been here several years, and they said, I've never felt so Australian. I've never felt so Australian. I'm not even Indigenous. I said, but I've never felt so connected to my fellow Aussies. And that's what I certainly hope for. And I'm pretty sure that's what will happen if we get a yes. You know, it'll just be this overwhelming sense of joy, and because it sends a signal to all of us that we can do this, that we are connected.
Well said. As we walk this home, how you often speak about having a great childhood, and I've noted that in a few of your interviews. You keep saying I've had a great childhood, and I'd like to just know, now that I know you a bit more, how do you define a great childhood so that we just get to know you even better?
You know, someone at work when I was at Lendlease, they asked it a different way. They said to me, it was patronizing, but I think, whatever. And then with my boss, and there was a little power play, and I still wasn't sure how to deal with it. And he said, how come you seem good, Charles? Like, you're like a good person and you've got a degree and blah, blah, blah. And then he said something, and I just said to him, I had a really good family.
Yeah.
And that meant You know, I was protected in my naivety in a sense. I didn't know what the world really was until I left my safety of Derby. But my parents put food on the table. They weren't perfect. They had their ups and downs. They put food on the table. We had rules. My mother was a demon making sure that we cleaned up and we had jobs and we had to make our bed and stuff. But we played. We were given love. We were given, and that's that control and safety. We knew we were safe. We knew where we had to be. We knew that we could go with our uncle or auntie. We could go fishing and camping. We were in a safe place in a town where there wasn't, I mean, there was some, you know, stuff that I found out later, but it takes, does take a community to raise a child in a village. My village was pretty good because we all looked after each other, black, white, blue and brindle. You know, and I've come from a big family. You know, we could go traverse families and stay at each other's house and stuff.
Mm.
And maybe because we were in a small country town, we had had this level of safety and isolation, which brought, you know, maybe a bit of naivety. But, you know, I don't think I really wanted for anything. We were working class. You know, we'd always like, you know, I wish we had more. But you realize now that family matters. We had cousins. We laughed. We did get in trouble. We did get in trouble and we got belted, you know, the old days. We did get a hiding, you know, and our parents, I mean, the whole political correct stuff, I'm not against any of that, but I suppose it was just a product of the 80s, yeah, and 70s, yeah. 80s, you yeah. know. So that's what we had, and we had a great environment. We had bikes, we could ride around, you know, we went fishing.
I've heard four attributes from this, and I love it because I'm also really interested in creating healthy family dynamics.
Yeah.
And I talk about a workplace organism and a family organism. They actually share pretty similar qualities. Yeah. Four words I've picked up that you said: protection,
yeah.
structure, love, and play.
Yeah.
And I think they are incredible ingredients to represent what a nurturing, caring, connected environment can look like for people.
Yeah, yeah. And I recognize it wasn't, now I recognize it wasn't that simple for my parents, mm. right? There were things I didn't know. I didn't know that my father was going, had racism, right?
It was experiencing racism.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm. So I found he worked on the RAF base. He was the first Aboriginal man, and they cleared the bush and stuff to build that RAF base.
Mm.
And I asked him about it one day, how he got the work there. And he said, because in the previous job, I was literally digging ditches for the public works, like they dug ditches and put in the pipes
tough
and stuff.
Fucking work.
Hard work. And his manager said, come on, you lazy black so-and-so. And he was standing up there and he was apparently a big guy, like white, whatever. But he said, my father pole vaulted out of that pit and went up to that guy's face and said, don't you ever speak to me. And the manager said, you know, go and try us and see how far you get, Blackie. My father threw the shovel down and quit his job. He said, I'm not going to do this. But he had five kids to feed, right? Like, you know. Mm. So he asked and got a job at the RAF base. It just happened, right? Mum said to me, Charles, you piggybacked that manager's daughter across the burning dirt. Because she was like, I can't, because she had no shoes on back at school. I didn't know any of that. It was like, so you piggyback his daughter across the burning, and then her father calls your father that, you know. Like, that's I didn't know that. And neither should I. I didn't need to know that.
Mm. That's the, as a child, you weren't maybe fully privy to all the context.
No. So you appreciate what your parents do for you.
Yeah.
You know, and it wasn't hard. It wasn't easy. It wasn't easy. But I love my parents.
I can hear that.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
So the last three questions, and they're just the three closes.
Oh, is that all?
No. For everyone. you're like, fucking hell, let me out here. This guy's grilling me. I've really enjoyed our chat. So what's one question you wish I'd asked you but I didn't?
Oh, I don't know. I can't think, to be honest, Mitch.
We'll come back to that.
Hmm.
What's one, this is maybe a bit of obvious given the what we've come in to talk about. But if you had a billboard above a highway for the next week and you could put one message on it, what would it be?
I don't know what the pitch is, but it's like, it would be please sit down and really listen.
Mm. I thought it was going to have something to do with listen.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what it takes.
What is the best piece of life advice you've ever personally been given?
Life advice? Well, my mother gives me a lot of advice. one step at a time.
Love that.
One step at a time.
And this is one just for this interview. What is a Indigenous either practice, behavior, or mindset that you think non-Indigenous people could benefit from with regard to building and cultivating mental health? So is there something that happens in the Indigenous community where you're like, God, I wish this was more well-known and adopted by non-Indigenous Australians?
And to be honest, I've been away, you know, from country. Like, I go home every year, but, you know, I'm not there every day.
Sure.
But so the Leon concept has been helping me a lot in this last year, particularly in the last This Voice. I've really clung to that.
Mm.
And for some, it might be your soul, your spirit, your heart, but there's a resonance for me of what that, because it's my cousins say it. It is something that I do feel like a connection to this land. If we can get more of that, or at least an understanding of that, right? And that's what for Australians, for First Nations people, if you can appreciate that and have that, own that, that's Australian.
Mm.
And I would love you to have it. I don't know if it's for you what it is, but to understand whatever it is for you, if your spirit, Mitch, or your, you know, for the people on the hearing this, is whatever that is for you, if we can understand that for each other.
Mm.
And for that to be able to be heard and valued and loved and listened to, then we're going to be much better off.
Sharing is one of the things that I take from the Indigenous culture a lot. And to be honest, borrow, if that's the right word, even in the work that we do, the devotion to storytelling, the aspect of circles, connection to nature. There's so many aspects of this, and I think Leon, is that how it's pronounced? The inner self. I think
there's your little person inside.
The little person.
Yeah,
I definitely want to look into that more because I think that's a concept that speaks to me personally as someone who has had to do a lot of work to rebuild some narratives of my younger self.
Yeah,
I would love to listen to you more around that at another time.
Yeah. Well, I'm not an expert, but, you know, just the concept, and it's helped me a lot.
Mm.
I think it's something that we can all kind of, you know, understand. I think, you know, I have helped. I don't know how much time we've got, but there's a guy at I see him around. He's either at the Central Train Station and he's around Redfern, and he's he's deaf. He is. And he's smart as all hell. And I've seen him be smart and funny. But I've also seen him be very upset. And I was in Woolies in Redfern. And, you know, he was down the drinks aisle looking for something. And he was very upset and he was loud. And because he's deaf and for whatever reason, those noises were not the you kind of associate with, well, it's not a normal noise,
mm-hmm.
but he was clearly upset. And then he was in a rush and, you know, he was trying to wait in line, you know, and I was in line and he's clearly upset. So he let him through, right? And then he put the stuff on the rolling thing for the to go through in the barcode stuff, and then he was looking for money and stuff, and he looked human being, he was upset, doesn't matter, you could see it, right? And I just said, brother, and everyone else was standing back, and I said, what, like, I'll pay for it, because he was in a rush as well, and I could hear, I thought I heard mum, right? I don't know if he was upset about his mum, maybe I'm making things up, but he was upset, and he just looked at me and nodded and then went off, right? That's a human being who was clearly in need of some kind of whatever he needed. If I could help, I did. You know, so I think if we can see each other, then we might be okay.
What a perfect story to end on. Yeah. I think that summarizes that entire chat just so well. If we can give and it's a win-win, then why not?
Yeah, why not? Didn't cost, no loss from me.
Yeah.
And I felt better. I was thinking, oh, these Liana, like, it makes me feel good.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Thanks so much, Charles, for an amazing discussion.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
No, that's all right. Thanks.